You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Today's show is also brought to you by our Patreon supporters, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Scurvy Pete, Kane, Kinway, Heyfei, Zuman, Nopales, Blacktip, Matthew the Navigator, Mossman, LeChuck, Bull, Vertigon, Conifalinde, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. Today we are going to talk a little bit about Amsterdam. Most of you are already aware of my love of, and perhaps pathological need, to give historical context as far back as possible. Usually I try for early classical civilization, but I'll go as far back as the Neolithic if I can. Fortunately for all of you, though, I can't do that in the case of Amsterdam. If I were to try, I would have to brush up on my marine biology. Amsterdam was, until around the 10th century, underwater. They built dikes there in the Netherlands to keep the sea at bay, and within a couple of centuries the land was suitable for building and farming. Amsterdam was officially recognized as a city in 1306. Now, there were already people living there, but once it was recognized, it almost immediately became an important city in European trade. There were competitors in the Netherlands, but Amsterdam became a central hub for both ships and land-based caravans. Germany, Poland, Denmark, France, England, Sweden, they all had major shipping routes through Amsterdam. And that's not to mention the rest of the Netherlands or Belgium or Spain or eventually Russia. Essentially, all continental trade that was going out or coming in from the North Sea went through the Netherlands, and most of that went through Amsterdam. And that's basically all the historical context I plan on giving about Amsterdam. It was a young city, and it was a rich city, and it became a cultural hub as well. But for as big a part as the Dutch will play in our ongoing pirate drama, the medieval period of Dutch history is relatively quiet and short. They really became major players in what Philip Goss called that year of years in modern history, 1492. And that happened largely due to the Sephardi Jewish diaspora. This is episode 81. A funny thing happened on the way to Amsterdam. The more and more I read up on the Sephardi Jewish diaspora and mull it over in my mind, I begin to think that it may have been, in some ways, an even more important moment than Columbus making contact with the New World. Maybe not to the Aztec people or Inca people or other native people in the Americas, but it had wide-ranging ripples all throughout history. I mean, look at it this way. The Vikings visited the Muslim world in the Middle Ages, and they shared their shipbuilding techniques between them. Then those Arabian ships made their way to Iberia with the Emirate of Cordoba. That combination of Arab and Norse and Iberian shipbuilding techniques led to the caravel and the carrack and finally to the galleon. All three of these ships were far better than anything that had come before. They were faster. They didn't require oar power, usually. They were better suited for long range and oceanic travel. And in the case of the galleon, they were better armed than any other ship in the Western world. These Iberian vessels allowed Spain and Portugal to build two of the largest empires that the world has ever known. Now imagine that the year is 1945. The atomic bomb has been developed and finally, in Japan, put to use. It was the most powerful weapon the world had ever seen, and the world knew it. There was an arms race all throughout the early 20th century, especially during World War II, and now that arms race had been won. And then, did the President of the United States, Harry Truman, decide to kick Albert Einstein out of the country? Not only Einstein, but all of the other exiled European Jewish physicists that helped to develop the bomb? Of course he didn't. That would have been incredibly stupid. Not only did they help to win that war, did they put an end to the war in Japan, they had secrets that needed to be kept in America for as long as possible. You don't want to give that away to another country by exiling somebody out of stupid, foolish, xenophobic racism. So why did Ferdinand and Isabella, at the culmination of their arms race, this was an arms race that had gone on throughout the Middle Ages, and it ended up with Spain firmly out in front, why did they decide to kick out the Sephardi Jews? The answer is obvious. They felt on top of the world, and it was inspired by anti-Semitic racism. But it seems incredibly foolish to me. The Jewish people were well known for writing things down. They had a spectacular language, and they used it to record things better, or at least as well as, anyone else in Europe. Not to mention, many of those Sephardi Jews had a very personal, intimate working relationship with the shipyards and the merchant fleets of Spain and Portugal. Those exiles took that knowledge with them when they were forced to leave, and we've already seen how that worked out for the Ottoman Empire. The Sultan Suleiman welcomed in this educated, middle-class elite with open arms. Oruj and his heir Barbarossa worked tirelessly to bring them in. And the Ottomans put all that knowledge that was now a part of their empire to use. They had printing presses and medicine, as well as new designs for ships. And then the combined Arab and Turkish and Berber and Jewish corsairs kicked the Catholics all around the Mediterranean. They won the Mediterranean for 30 years. The late Middle Ages, for the Jewish population of Spain, is considered a golden age. Science, medicine, sanitation, education was all significantly better than anywhere else in Europe. And then the Catholic monarchs kicked them out. And wouldn't you know it, when they all arrived in the Ottoman Empire, we saw the dawn of the Ottoman Golden Age. Not the Islamic Golden Age, that's a different thing entirely, but under Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Empire expanded further and became more prosperous and powerful than it ever had been before. Not all of that was exactly due to the Jewish diaspora and their influx into the Ottoman Empire, but their influence certainly helped, and it may not have been as strong as it was without them. That's due to a number of factors, but those shipbuilding techniques were certainly part of it. But the Ottoman Empire wasn't the only landing site for Sephardi Jewish exiles. First, most of them went to Portugal. Remember the conversos who were crypto-Jews hiding in Portugal? Well, that happened right when Portugal was using their brand new ship designs to start up the first global empire. And this might be a good moment to talk very briefly about the early Portuguese Empire. Now, we're going to talk a lot more about them in the days to come, but for now, we need a basis for how the Portuguese Empire interacted with the Jewish world and the Muslim world. See, the Portuguese were an empire that expanded even before the Spanish did, or at least, at first, they were much more successful. Remember Henry the Navigator? He established dozens of African colonies in the latter half of the 1400s, and most of those colonies were in Morocco, on the Atlantic coast of North Africa. Now, as you might imagine, the Moroccans weren't terribly pleased about all of this, but Portugal promised lucrative trade and protection from the Ottoman Empire. And it did actually sort of work out that way. It was kind of like a mob shakedown, though. You know, a couple of Portuguese princes might come into your shop one day and say, "Hey, I hear these Ottomans have been giving you a little trouble. Not to worry, my friend, we'll take care of that little problem for you. All you gotta do is let us set up shop around here, and every once in a while we'll come behind the counter, open up the register, and strip literally all of the mineral wealth in gold and silver out of your country. And if you give us any hassle, we might have to smack yous around a little bit, rough up the place, maybe assassinate a caliph or two. And when the Spanish needed a place to make landfall, usually to make war on the Ottomans, which was fine with the Moroccans, it was Morocco that had to oblige. Now, the Moroccan Sultanate, what's called the Wattasid dynasty, were Berbers, North African natives, that were descended from ancient Berber kings. They had seized power when the last Arabian dynasty declined there in Morocco. Now, the Wattasids were firmly in the pro-Portuguese, pro-Spanish, anti-getting swallowed by the Ottoman Empire camp. However, there were a large number of Arab, rather than Berber, Muslim nobles in Morocco. They were the remnants of the Caliphate of Cordoba that had fled to Morocco during the Reconquista. Most of those Arab princes moved to Morocco after 1492. And suffice it to say, those exiles from Spain hated the Catholics that had kicked them out of their homes. They comprised the anti-Portuguese, anti-Spanish, we're cool with the Ottomans camp. They were ethnically and culturally distinct from the rest of Morocco, and they're going to play a major role in the piracy to come. But when they left the Cordoban Caliphate, they originally settled in the southern parts of Morocco, and they established a base of power there. Now, they called themselves the Sa'idi dynasty, but they officially recognized the Wattasid Sultan as their king and the king of Morocco. Then, when the Pope signed the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, he told the Portuguese that they could have Brazil and Africa and Asia. So, Portuguese ships set sail. Bartolomeu Diaz and Vasco da Gama colonized eastern Africa and much of Asia. When we get to the Pirates of the Round and the Red Sea Men, we'll have to cover all of that in a lot more depth. But the point is, the Portuguese used their amazing ships that were influenced by many of the Jewish designs from Jewish shipbuilders that had come to Portugal to create an empire. Now again, this wasn't all due to the Jewish influence on shipbuilding, but that probably helped the empire grow. But then Spain began to crack down on the Portuguese conversos, so those Jews in Portugal fled elsewhere. Now, we've already talked a bit about the Jews that went to America. Lima and Jamaica and Veracruz and Panama, they all benefited from the Jewish mercantile and medical and educational influence. And we're going to return to them later, especially Jamaica and then on to Brazil, but for now, the New World's really far away from our story, and most of the Jews that made it out to the Americas already had connections and some funds to help establish themselves in the New World. But the Jewish people that didn't have as much looked closer to home. Going to America was expensive, and even going to the Ottoman Empire took some amount of independence, but going to other places in Europe, well, a couple of decades earlier, that wouldn't have been, well, it would have been troublesome, to say the least. In 1492, Europe was still uniformly Catholic and deeply anti-Semitic. Where could a group of exiles go if they were Jewish? There was Italy or France or Austria, most of Europe, in fact, that would have persecuted them, even worse than the Spanish had in some cases. But then only a few years later, these Portuguese conversos received some help from an unexpected and deeply anti-Semitic source, an Augustinian friar named Martin Luther. Now, Luther's feelings toward the Jewish people are well documented, and he certainly didn't have any intention of helping them. But when he sparked the Reformation in protest against the monolithic Catholic Church, well, Protestants and Jews found out that they had one major thing in common. So some Jews were able to find happy homes in many of the Protestant-leaning regions of Europe. There were some German states that would take them in. Some went to Denmark. When the Huguenots started making waves in France, some Jews found homes there as well. Now, not all Protestants were friendly with the Jewish people, some of them very, very far from it. But with the printing press and translations of the Bible into languages that they could actually read, many Protestants began to learn that the Jews were not, in fact, a cabal of demonic devil worshippers. I mean, many of them learned for the very first time that Jesus was himself Jewish. But there was one harbor in Europe that was particularly welcoming toward the Sephardi Jews, and that was Amsterdam. Now, whether or not the Netherlands would have been so welcoming under normal circumstances, even with all of their Calvinists and Lutherans mucking around, is up for debate. They had a history, in some cases, of not being so welcoming to the Jewish people. But at the moment, they had bigger problems than a few Jewish refugees. The Netherlands had an Anabaptist problem. The Netherlands was something of a breeding ground for Anabaptist sects, in particular, radical apocalyptic cults. One minister named Melchior Hoffman was preaching that Jesus was going to return in the city of Strasbourg in 1533. He was going to purge the wicked and carry the faithful to heaven. Jesus, not Hoffman. Now, that didn't happen. But two of his followers, Jan Matthias and Jan van Leyden, told everyone, "Wait, no, it's not happening in Strasbourg, and it's not in 1533. But Jesus was coming back to the city of Munster in 1534. Now, I assume most of you have heard this story already if you are the type of person that enjoys to listen to history podcasts. And it's a good story. If you haven't heard it, go find Dan Carlin's episode on it and listen immediately. Well, you know, after you're done with this episode. But for anyone not familiar with the story, these Anabaptists took over Munster. They kicked out all of the Catholics and then kicked out all of the moderate Lutherans. They instituted some archaic Old Testament religiosity, and they renamed Munster the New Jerusalem. And I'd like you to remember that name, New Jerusalem, for later. The forces of Catholicism there in Germany besieged Munster for months, and the whole ordeal ended in what was basically an apocalyptic battle for this particular sect of Anabaptists. Only there wasn't the whole salvation and returning to heaven thing. There was torture and execution. Now, Munster was a German city under the umbrella of the Holy Roman Empire. And at the time, Charles V was the Holy Roman Emperor. He was also, though, the Lord of the Netherlands. And he made sure that the Dutch Anabaptists, who had in some ways influenced and created this trouble in Munster, were going to pay for the crimes of those Anabaptists. They executed every Anabaptist they could get their hands on in the Netherlands. It was a fairly major undertaking, actually. So when those Spanish Sephardi Jews left Charles's Spain and slipped into Charles's Amsterdam, the king and the Inquisition were a bit busy dealing with bigger problems. They were dealing with those Anabaptist heretics. The Jews were mostly allowed to just go on their way, so long as they left Spain and Portugal. Now, the next few decades saw more and more Jews and those crypto-Jews travel from Spain and Portugal to the Ottoman Empire, to Jamaica, and to Amsterdam. Now, remember that throughout all of this, the Barbary Corsairs were still doing their thing in the Mediterranean. Barbarossa and the heirs of Barbarossa were continuing their reigns of terror all along the Spanish and Italian coasts. The Ottoman Empire and Europe were still fighting for control of the Mediterranean. But our story of Amsterdam really picks up in 1566. Charles V was no longer in power by this time, nor was his brother. It was actually his nephew, Maximilian II, that was the Holy Roman Emperor. Philip II was the King of Spain. He was the son of Charles V, and Elizabeth I, who was Charles V's aunt's ex-husband's daughter and his son's sister-in-law and prospective wife-to-be, well, Elizabeth was Queen of England. 1566, though, was the year in which a number of Dutch Calvinists went around burning down Catholic churches. They destroyed what they saw as iconoclastic effigies, and they killed a number of priests and many, many Catholic parishioners. That's what's called the Bildenstrom. In 1568, 2 years later, the States General of the Seven United Dutch Provinces and the most powerful nobleman in the Netherlands, a man named William of Orange, or William of Nassau, or William the Silent, began the Dutch Revolt to oust their hated overlord, the Duke of Alba. Now, we talked about all of this long, long ago. There's no reason to rehash the Dutch Revolt and the Sea Beggars here. If you're not familiar, you can go back and listen to some of our earliest episodes. If you'd just like a refresher, maybe this is a good time. The point, though, is this Bildenstrom and this Dutch Revolt actually made things a bit hard for the Spanish Jews living in the Netherlands. There is this sentiment that was very prevalent in medieval Europe, and the Nazis even brought it back in much of their anti-Jewish propaganda. It suggests that the Jewish people are a people without a nation, or at least a people that do not belong to any nation aside from Israel. And that sentiment made them outsiders, even in what were their own birthplaces, their national homes. This idea suggests that Jews are always foreigners, no matter where they were born. They were people of Judea, wherever they might actually reside. Now, that's all nonsense. I know American Jews that are more American than most Americans in all the traditional senses. Football and burgers and beer. Red-blooded Americans, right? And then the German Jews were largely patriotic Germans. Many of them fought proudly for Germany in World War I. And those Spanish Sephardi Jews that were kicked out of Spain, well, they were Spanish. Some of them spoke Hebrew, yeah, but all of them spoke Spanish. And when they spoke Dutch, they did so with a Spanish accent. Now, some of them were named in the Hebrew tradition, mostly the rabbis, but most of them had names like Diego or Louis or Francisco or Pedro or Maria. So, when the Dutch were engaging in the Bildenstrom and killing and being killed by Spaniards during their revolt, that could cause trouble. When a group of Sephardi Jewish immigrants with Spanish names went around speaking in Spanish or Spanish accents. Most of these new immigrants didn't yet speak Dutch, so they faced sometimes persecution, but usually that was too strong of a word. Hostility, though, definitely works in this situation. Not for being Jewish, though. That would usually have been the case, but here it was for being Spanish. Edward Kritzler tells us about two men. They were named Joseph Diaz Soyero and Antonio Enrique. Those are pretty perfect Iberian names. They were Jewish, though, and they were visiting a secret Jewish synagogue there in Amsterdam that was meeting late one evening. There were a number of local Jews gathered within, when all of a sudden the doors were kicked in by local officials. Now, the Sephardi Jews that were refugees to Amsterdam, well, they were used to this sort of behavior, relatively speaking. In their experience, coming from Spain and Portugal, it was the Inquisition that usually did this sort of thing. And these worshippers naturally thought that this was the Inquisition as well. You might say that they had been trained to expect the Spanish Inquisition. Never mind. So, the people that were there, they ran. The ones that didn't get away, and that's most of them, they were nearly all arrested, but not for practicing Judaism. They were arrested for being a group of Spaniards in a secret meeting speaking Spanish during the Dutch Revolt. But here's the kicker. They didn't speak Dutch, and their captors didn't speak Spanish, despite this being the formerly Spanish Netherlands. So these Jews didn't understand that they were being arrested for their Spanish rather than Jewish heritage. But before I complete the story of Joseph Diaz and Antonio Enrique and all of the Jews that were so recently arrested, we need to take a step back and look at two things. First, in the year 1580, the crowns of Spain and Portugal combined in what they call the Iberian Union, King Philip II of Spain became King Philip I of Portugal. He would further confuse that issue by naming his son Philip, the third and second, and having a grandson also named Philip, the fourth and third. And you know how Charles V was kinda cool about the Jews? Like, yes, I am the Grand High Inquisitor, and you Jews are all heretics, but you can go to Portugal or Jamaica or Amsterdam, and even though I am technically the lord of all of those places, I'll just sort of look the other way so long as you're not in Spain. Now, he wasn't going to be winning any prizes for inclusiveness, and the Jews, in many cases, suffered terribly under his rule, but it could have been a lot worse. Well, when his son was in charge, Philip II, it was a lot worse. When he took over the crown of Portugal in 1580, priority number one was to deal with all of these conversos. Now, he knew full well most of the Portuguese conversos were crypto-Jews. Everyone did. It was an open secret. They were practicing their religion in secret, so he decided to deal with that problem. And, you know, that wasn't really priority number one. Priority number one was incorporating the Portuguese Empire into Spain's empire, which would create the largest empire the world had ever known, an empire on which the sun literally never set that generated more wealth than had ever been seen in world history. But then, priority number two, the Jews. Philip II and First decided to deal with them in... well, it was a centuries-old practice that he decided to use, called the auto de fe. That's, in English, an act of faith. Edward Kritzler, once again, describes these better than I ever could. He writes, quote, "The date was January 16, 1606. Freezing winds blowing off the Atlantic did nothing to deter the citizens of Lisbon from crowding the roadside to jeer the prisoners on their way to the plaza to be tried at the auto de fe. The victims, barefoot and naked to the waist, were whipped along the icy cobblestone streets by white-hooded guards of the Holy Brotherhood. On horseback, heading the procession, were the familiars of the Holy Office, wearing black tunics silhouetted with a white cross. Behind them, the 155 half-naked penitents stumbled along, six abreast, their backs lashed raw by the guards' studded whips. The Judaizers carried unlit candles to signify that the light of the true faith had not yet illuminated their souls."
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
This is one of those things that, you know, living in the age of terrorism, I can imagine, in the modern world even, a group of bearded, unwashed religious radicals, not entirely unlike pirates, showing up on some faraway shore and killing and robbing and kidnapping. I can mentally put myself in the world where that sort of thing happens. I mean, pirates are doing that off the coast of Africa today. In Syria and Yemen and Libya, those things are all happening. So when I read about Henry Morgan or Blackbeard, I get that. I can contextualize it, but this auto de fe, this act of faith, I can't imagine anything like that in today's world. And things like that are still happening. There are religious atrocities and ethnic cleansings that are not unheard of. But Spain, and I realize this might paint me as a Western elitist, but in 1600, Spain was the world power, and Lisbon was a major city in that empire. Can you imagine something like the atrocities that are taking place in the more remote parts of Asia today, happening in San Francisco or Rio de Janeiro or Shanghai or Amsterdam or, you know, Lisbon? It seems like this just unimaginable atrocity. But here's the thing. To the people of Lisbon, this was seen as a mercy. It was public shaming and physical torture, but it was in the service of repentance and the majesty of God's love. These inquisitors and the authorities and the jeering masses, well, they believed that they were doing these Jews a service. They were helping them to get into heaven. Edward Kritzler continues, quote, "Prisoners not admitting their guilt were tortured until they did. Those who remained unrepentant were liable to be burned. Age made no difference. 10-year-old sisters were tortured, and a 96-year-old woman burned at the stake." And he continues, "Having seen the light, they could light their candles and donate a fifth of their possessions to the church." End quote. And donate is very heavily in quotes. Now, two of the prisoners that were present there in Lisbon at this auto da fé in 1606 were none other than Joseph Diaz and Antonio Enrique. They were part of that procession. They were whipped. They were tortured. But they were fortunate enough to be set free. And this was actually pretty lucky. The inquisitor who was in charge of that particular auto da fé in Lisbon, well, he was well known for disbelieving the conversions professed by his Jewish prisoners. He was known for torturing them until he finally believed in their conversion, at which point he did them the service of sending them straight up to heaven. Now, history catches up with Antonio and Joseph a few years later in that secret synagogue in Amsterdam. But before we conclude their story, we need to talk about that second element in that Dutch raid. And we actually get a bit of piracy here, believe it or not. The reason that we are fortunate enough to know anything about Joseph and Antonio is because of one man. He was a Jewish Moroccan merchant, a diplomat, and a pirate named Samuel Palash. Now, we're not going to get a lot of piracy here, more intrigue and espionage, but it was done by a pirate. We know a fair bit about Samuel Palash, thanks to the records, the glorious records, kept by those Sephardi Jews. His family was Iberian. They came from Spain, but during the Reconquista, they were pushed further and further south until they resided in Cordoba, with the last of the Muslims in Spain to have a foothold there. Now, Samuel's father was a rabbi in Cordoba. But after the Reconquista was completed, at some point after 1492, Samuel's father brought his wife to Morocco. Now, Aruj and Hizir Barbarossa and Sinan Reis were all supposed to bring any Jews that they got from Spain to the Ottoman Empire, and Morocco wasn't a part of the Ottoman Empire. It was an independent caliphate. So it's unlikely that the Palash family came over with those Barbary pirates, but it's not impossible, especially with Sinan Reis. He would have probably been sympathetic to their plight. And they knew people in Morocco already. Now, Samuel was born there in Morocco, in the city of Fez, in a Jewish ghetto. His father took up rabbinical duties in the city, and Samuel was given a good Jewish religious and secular education. As he grew older, he took up a seaborne trade, though. Edward Kritzler tells us that, though the gates of his Jewish ghetto were closed every night, Samuel and his brother Joseph were allowed to pass those gates freely. And they were given this boon for a very specific reason. It was known in the community that their nighttime activities were extracurricular to their regular merchant duties. They were the sort of activities that would enrich the entire city at the expense of Spain. It was smuggling and piracy and fencing stolen goods. And I should mention here that most of the piratical details we have on Samuel Palash come from two sources. There's Edward Kritzler, and then there's a Spanish writer named Mercedes Garcia Arenal. Now, they interpret much of Palash's life as one of piracy, and even though that's somewhat controversial, I'm going to follow their lead here. Now, most of the piracy occurring in the Western Mediterranean was due to the Barbarossas and their fleet. It was coming from the Barbary states, but Palash was a central figure in the piracy coming out of Morocco. He was really the only major player there at the time, and he used the Strait of Gibraltar as his hunting ground. Now, the guards allowed him to pass through. Well, even though Morocco was allied to Spain technically, they had a strange sort of relationship. They were allies, but they were allies kind of like the U.S. and Pakistan are allies. They were at peace, but they hated each other. They'd signed treaties of alliance, not because they were friends, but because they needed each other. Spain needed a friendly place to land in North Africa, and Morocco needed Spain to protect them from the Ottoman Empire. And both of them wanted friendly relations there in the Strait of Gibraltar. Without it, it would create unbelievable problems. If they broke out into open fighting, the strait would be closed, and access between the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean shut down. So, the Moroccan guards there at the Jewish ghetto in Fez, they winked and they nodded, and they let Samuel Palash through to go steal Spanish goods along the coast and bring them home to be bought up by locals at a very fair price. Now, Kritzler also tells us that one of Samuel's favorite tactics was to steal Spanish goods, either on the coast or out at sea, and then repackage them in his own merchant packaging and sell them back to the Spanish at a markup. Now, most of the Spanish probably knew that this was happening. And it was a bit petty, maybe, but it was profitable. And it was the sort of revenge that a religious minority within the country of an inferior member of an alliance could get away with. But then, Samuel and Joseph Palash were contacted by the Moroccan Sultan. And here's where this story intersects with that story of the Barbarossas. See, Barbarossa's son, Hassan Pasha, was the Pasha of Algiers, and he was looking for something big and bold that would impress the Sultan, and he decided that would be interfering in Morocco. That anti-Portuguese set in Morocco from Cordoba, the Saadi dynasty, well, they had ousted a number of Portuguese settlements from their southernmost holdings in Morocco, and Hassan Pasha was impressed by that. He liked their moxie. So he agreed to help the Saadi dynasty in their war on Portugal and with the Wattasid dynasty in Morocco if they promised to be allies with him in Algiers. Then he took the city of Tlemcen and handed that to the Saadi. Now, do you remember there was an old Looney Tunes cartoon in which there was a tiny, scrappy little mouse that picked a fight with the local tomcat outside. The mouse was all, put him up, and the cat's like, what is this guy doing? Then the cat just picks up the mouse and pops him in his mouth. But then the bulldog shows up from around the corner, and it turns out he's actually friends with that little mouse. So the cat opens his mouth, pulls the mouse out, sets him down nicely, and pats him on the head. That's kind of how I see this interaction with Tlemcen and the Saadi and the Wattasids. Now, Tlemcen was in Morocco at the time. Today, it's part of Algiers. You can see where this is headed, but not for a minute yet. Now, Hassan Pasha didn't ask permission to take Tlemcen, to get involved in Moroccan politics. His father never asked permission either, or rarely did, but he had the military strength and the popularity to back up his territorial claims. He also had the political pull back in Istanbul to get away with his more audacious moves. Hassan Pasha had a famous father, but he didn't have any of that other stuff. He wasn't popular, he wasn't famous, and he wasn't powerful, and he had no political pull. So that was the moment when Hassan was pushed out as the Pasha of Algiers, and Dragut, who did have all of those things, assumed control of Algiers. Now, Tlemcen was a liability, for the Ottoman Empire, for the Sultan in particular. It potentially would open up a whole new theater of war that Suleiman was not yet prepared to fight in. There was fighting all over the Ottoman Empire, on many of her frontiers, and Suleiman didn't want to open up a new front. So he smoothed it over with the Moroccan Sultan, a man named Zidane. Dragut sent an embassy, or rather, Hassan Aga, that eunuch who was in actual control of Algiers, to tell Zidane that they were not going to be interfering in his political world. They were not going to be offering any support to the Saadi dynasty. And Zidane was able to send an army to take back Tlemcen. The Wattasid tomcat popped that Saadi mouse into its mouth. But Zidane realized here what a tight spot he was in. He had Algiers and the Ottoman Empire interfering on one side of his kingdom, even if the Sultan promised that they wouldn't do so again. On the other side of his kingdom, he had Spain and pirates like Samuel Palash clashing and causing ripples. Now, Spain knew full well that the Sultan, Zidane, could have stopped those pirates out of Morocco any time that he chose to do so. But rather than demand that he do that, the Spanish just politely looked the other way while the Sultan openly worked with the pirates. Now, the Spanish captured and killed any of those Moroccan pirates when and where they were able to, and the Sultan just politely looked the other way. That's just how business was done. And it was that way because when Samuel Palash was at the height of his raiding, Spain was at war with England. This was the latter half of the 16th century. Francis Drake, the Spanish Armada, the shipyards at Cadiz being burned, tons of Spanish silver being buried all across the Isthmus at Panama. You know, that little war. So Spain was too busy to spend many resources hunting a few Jewish pirates in the Mediterranean. But when that war was over, Zidane needed to reestablish relations with his old friends, the Spanish, who he had always been close with and never aided pirates in capturing their ships just because he could. So Sultan Zidane needed somebody to undertake a mission to Spain. And that's when he contacted the pirate and merchant Samuel Palash. Now his job was going to be to carry a cargo of gems and spices to trade them for beeswax that was necessary to make candles. They didn't have much of that in Morocco. But that's not all his job was. He wanted Samuel Palash to be a double agent. Palash was to undertake his trading mission, that was normal, but then he was supposed to tell the Spanish authorities that he really wanted to defect. He had tons of state secrets about Zidane's court. Everybody knew that he had been there before. So he was to feed the Spanish false information and to spy on the Spanish for Zidane. Now this is the sort of story that would just make a fantastic movie. And I think it might already exist in Spain. I wouldn't be surprised if it did. But for 4 years after that initial mission, Samuel Palash played a dangerous game with the Duke of Medina Sidonia, the Spanish ambassador, and King Philip II himself. He got involved in court politics in Madrid. He lined the right pockets, and he even played powerful Spanish nobles off one another. The Duke of Medina Sidonia was, well, he was his first patron there in Spain. He was a viceroy in Morocco, so he was the first powerful Spanish contact he made. So for most of the first few years, the Duke would defend Samuel Palash to the king and all of the nobles at court. Now, of course, the Duke was getting rich off the piracies of Samuel Palash at the expense of his own countrymen. His patronage finally ran out, though, in the year 1605. Things were getting a bit hot. Some people were noticing that he was getting rich off some piracies. But King Philip asked the Duke if Palash could be trusted to, quote, find things out about Barbary. The Duke replied to him, though, his business is all trickery. But at that point, Samuel Palash no longer needed the patronage of the Duke of Medina Sidonia. See, he'd spun a good tale into the ear of King Philip II, and just a few weeks after asking the Duke that question, the King granted Samuel Palash a license to settle down in Madrid. He decided that, even though the Duke didn't trust him, I can trust him to find things out about Barbary. So Palash began preparations to find a nice little house in Madrid and settle down, but before he could, the Inquisition caught wind of him. This was actually the Duke's doing here. He had confessed everything, all of his crimes, to the Inquisition, telling them the entire time that he knew this man, who was now a confidant of the king, was a Jew and a spy, and he meant nothing but evil for Spain. Before he could actually move in there in Madrid, Samuel Palash ran for it. And he was in Madrid at the time. He didn't have a home in Spain, but he was living there. So we're talking about a series of narrow escapes with soldiers of the Spanish Inquisition. We're talking about daring chases through the streets and alleys of Madrid. There were a couple of swashbuckling scrapes with some of those authorities. It's all very Three Musketeers and Alexander Dumas and Errol Flynn. But Samuel Palash landed at the home of the French ambassador in Madrid. Now, the homes of ambassadors at the time worked very much like a modern-day embassy. The crown had virtually no authority there, which was good for the French ambassador and for Palash. Now, when all of this was going on, the king of France was Henry IV. He was a member of the Bourbon dynasty and himself a Calvinist Protestant. So Palash felt relatively safe in the home of an official rival of Spain, and a man who was a fellow religious minority member. Now, the ambassador's home there in Madrid overlooked the town square, and Palash couldn't leave, so he had to spend every Friday looking out those windows at the town square at the Auto da Fe of Madrid. Every Friday, he had to watch Sephardi Jews get beaten and tortured and interrogated and marched through town and publicly shamed. Every Friday he did this for 6 whole months. Now, we don't have a record of Samuel Palash's departure from the ambassador's home, or of his escape from Spain, but we can surmise from some of the hard-bitten historical data that surrounds the event that, at one point, Palash would pull out his sword, grab a rope, slash the knot that was tying it down, and ride that rope to the rafters while a chandelier on the other end fell on the heads of his bumbling opponents. Then he shouted, "Adios, muchachos," and slashed an S in the tapestry and then rode off into the night. But when history actually catches up with Palash, we find him in Amsterdam. At some point after leaving the ambassador's home, he made his way to the Netherlands. And we catch up with him at a meeting with the Prince of Orange, with Maurice of Nassau, that was William the Silent's son. Now, we're going to look at that meeting later, but Samuel Palash didn't just waltz into the office of the Stadtholder as some unknown agent. See, Palash wasn't just a pirate and a smuggler or a spy. He was the son of a rabbi. He was, in his own right, a successful merchant, and by this point he was even a well-known diplomat. And during his years of intrigue between Medina Sidonia and Philip II, Samuel had made more than a few side trips to the Netherlands. He'd been chased off, actually, a few times by local pastors and other diplomats in the Netherlands, but he found a community there, in Amsterdam, of fellow Jews, Sephardi Jews. His uncle actually might already have been living there in Amsterdam, so he may have had a good reason to go visit him. But in addition to all of the spying in Spain, he acted as something of a Harriet Tubman, or a Moses, or maybe a Baba or Rouge, to many of the crypto-Jews that were hiding in Portugal and Spain, that were facing the Auto da Fe. He may have gotten word to many of those people he saw beaten and tortured in the streets of Madrid, telling them that he had a way to get them to Amsterdam, where there was a community that would accept them. He was a guiding light for many of the Portuguese conversos that had tried to stay in Iberia and make a life but realized it would no longer be possible. Now, it started off with the family of Samuel Palash, but then his friends, and then their families, and then their friends, and then their families. Now, this wasn't entirely Palash's doing, but he was kind of at the forefront of this exodus toward Amsterdam. In just a few years' time, Amsterdam would house tens of thousands of Sephardi exiles. and it was Palash that was the trimmer that sparked that tidal wave. Samuel Palash found himself in Amsterdam well before his meeting with the Stadtholder, on that very evening that Josef Diaz and Antonio Henrique were arrested in that raid on the secret synagogue. In fact, he probably set up that meeting. He knew the trustworthy Jews in Amsterdam. He knew most of the locals. These were the sort of backroom meetings that Palash was familiar with, not just as a pirate and not just as a smuggler and a spy, but as a crypto-Jew working in Spain. Josef and Antonio were both fresh off the boat. They had just recently arrived from Lisbon, and they were aided in getting to Amsterdam by Samuel Palash, and he showed them places where they could find friends and aid. The service would look strange to any modern Jews or anybody familiar with the practices of modern-day Judaism. See, Samuel Palash's uncle was a rabbi. He knew the ins and outs of Jewish religious practices probably better than anyone else in Amsterdam. But even that, he had been living as an Iberian for many years and then an exile in Morocco. He likely didn't have a copy of the Torah until he moved to Amsterdam. He likely didn't have any experience with real religious services. He'd spent his entire life attending Catholic or perhaps Muslim services. He knew that he was Jewish and his family was Jewish, but at this point, most of these Jewish exiles in Amsterdam didn't really know what that meant. They had tales, oral histories, passed down to them, but they didn't have any written record of their religious past or their religious teachings. So they were figuring out a lot of this for the first time. Now, everyone there at that secret religious ceremony was new to Amsterdam, and none of them spoke much Dutch. Samuel Palash's uncle, if he was there, spoke the best, but I don't think he was, so it was probably Samuel himself that spoke the best Dutch, but even that was rudimentary. He knew Berber from Morocco, he knew Hebrew, and he knew Spanish, and I think a little Greek and Arabic, but he only knew the most basic of Dutch. Now, remember that this secret synagogue was not being raided for being Jewish, but they were arrested for being a group of obvious Spaniards meeting in secret during the Dutch revolt against Spain. But none of them knew that. They didn't speak any Dutch, so when the authorities kicked down the door and arrested them, they just assumed it was for practicing Judaism. Now, Palash attempted to gauge the situation here, but when a bunch of cops bust down your door and start screaming at you in Dutch while you're being put in chains, that's not exactly the best moment to overcome a language barrier. He did his best to explain the situation in Spanish, and though these were the formerly Spanish Netherlands, the guards didn't speak any Spanish. He tried Greek and he tried Hebrew, but he didn't have any better luck. But then the local rabbi, Palash's uncle, showed up while everyone was being hauled off to what we can only assume was a dark, dank dungeon somewhere. Now, he spoke the best Dutch, but he spoke spectacular Latin, and so did the Dutch officials. So he was actually able to speak to the guards in Dutch and convince them to lead the prisoners to a magistrate rather than a dungeon, and before the magistrate, in Latin, he was able to explain the situation. You know, look, I know they all have Spanish names, and they all speak with Spanish accents, but they aren't agents of Spain, I promise you. Well, except my nephew, but he's a super-secret double agent, so that's fine. They hate Spain as much as you guys do. You hate being subject to Spanish whims? Well, they were Jews in hiding during the Inquisition, man. They will help you against the Spanish. I know you guys have been taking in Jewish families for decades now, and now you have a mass of wealthy, educated Jews that know the ins and outs of Spain intimately. Oh, and this guy here, Fernando, well, he knows how to build amazing ships just like those that are busy conquering the New World in Asia. Ever had any interest in taking over Portugal's many, many lucrative colonies there in Asia, Mr. Dutchman? Well, with those ships, you can do just that. Well, okay, maybe Samuel Palash's uncle didn't say all that, but he communicated the three important things that needed to be known here in Latin. Spain, bad. Jews, friends. Amsterdam, great. And that was all that the burgermeisters and stadtholders of Amsterdam needed to hear. After this little event, the pastors and the town fathers of Amsterdam got together and declared that the Jews in the city could practice Judaism openly. They were even allowed to build a synagogue. They were allowed to bring people in from Israel who knew the ins and outs of their religion. And they did so. Samuel Palash's father and his uncle became the first two rabbis of the synagogue of Amsterdam. And with that, the Portuguese Jews from all across Europe and even the Ottoman Empire began to come to Amsterdam in droves. In the end, it came to more than 50,000 Jewish men, women, and children in the city. And you know how there was this golden age in Spain when all of the Jews were still allowed to work and live and, you know, not be burned at the stake? And then there was that Ottoman golden age when Suleiman invited in all of the Sephardi Jews he could find? Well, the next few decades of Dutch history are called the Dutch golden age. They had medicine and mercantilism from the Jews. They had new shipbuilding techniques that allowed them to build fleets of flutes based on Spanish designs brought over by, you guessed it, Sephardi Jews. They established colonies in the New World and took over colonies from other powers, mostly from Spain and Portugal. And this wasn't all the Jews. There were many other economic and political factors feeding into this golden age, not to mention their revolution and self-determination. But the Jews were there, in large numbers now, and they helped. And then, to top all of this off with a dash of piracy, the Jewish merchant families in Amsterdam began to establish connections with the Jewish families on Jamaica, and between them, they began to build what would become a worldwide network of fencing, of illicit trade goods that would be stolen from Spain by the buccaneers and pirates of Port Royal and Tortuga and Nassau, and they would be sold to the Dutch merchants on their flutes and brought back to be fenced by the Jews of Amsterdam. But that's all looking way into the future. But all of that was sparked by this one Jewish Moroccan pirate named Samuel Palash. Next time, we're going to look at that meeting between Maurice of Nassau and Samuel Palash. That meeting established diplomatic relations between the United Dutch Provinces and Morocco, and those diplomatic relations led to a connection between Amsterdam and the Barbary states of Algiers and Tunis and Tripoli, which would lead us, directly through the actions of Samuel Palash, to the first great age of piracy, of real piracy, in the Mediterranean, since the days of Rome. And it will also lead us, through a very twisting road, to the construction of Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, all of our patrons on Patreon, everybody who has left us a review or suggested us to their friends and family. Without all of you, I couldn't do this. So thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you have yet to check them out, you can always do so at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com, or you can get in touch on Twitter, SoundCloud, or YouTube. As always, most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.